Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
Welcome to another episode. Today, as I said, we are continuing the Polish theme of the month, but it's not quite what you think. So it's not going to be a Polish person, it's not going to be a Polish text, but today's episode is still, I would say, interwoven with Polish history and culture in a way. So we're gonna start with a bit of a personal story because it's really funny. So when I was a teenager, I went to a summer camp in a castle in Western Poland. It was so beautiful. The location was absolutely incredible. I mean, we didn't sleep at the actual castle because it was too expensive, but we slept in former stables, I think, or some sort of like former staff quarters. Either way, that was a short walk from the castle. And I remember when I arrived, the host of the camp, they would just like keep bringing up a former participant. There were like several editions of this camp. So I thought they were referring to a former participant because they would be like, oh yeah, she rode horses here. Or like, oh yeah, she really liked this spot. And I was like, who the f*** was that person? And it took me, I think, a full day at least. In my defense, I was like 17, to realize that they were not in fact referring to a former teenager participant, but that they're referring to Princess Daisy of Pless, born 1873, who lived in the castle over 100 years before the camp that I took part in. So this was my first ever encounter with that name. And I have since realized and I have noticed that in certain areas of Poland, especially, there is this almost cult-like following surrounding her. Even though she has passed away in 1943, so quite a long time ago, and she's not really known abroad, like she's not really known in the UK where she comes from, and she's probably a little better known in Germany, but I feel like she's still this like celebrity person here in Poland, even though she wasn't even Polish. She had nothing to do with Poland, and it wasn't even Poland at the time. There is two castles in particular that are connected to her. They used to be German, but they are now in Poland. One of them is Fürstenberg, it's Książ in Polish, and the other one is Ples or Pszczyna in Polish. And I have to say, these are probably, well, not my favorite, because there is a lot of castles I like, but they're one of my favorite castles in Poland. And the first one, so the Fürstenberg Castle, is just so beautifully located on a hill in this like stunning valley. And it just looks like straight out of a fairy tale. Like when you reach the castle, you're like, this can't be real. There is a stunning ballroom in the center of the castle. There is a French style front yard. There is a mysterious back garden. There is like a labyrinth of walls and little towers. It's magical. And the area surrounding the castle is a beautiful forest and everything is just so nice. Though I have to say, I am a little more partial to the second castle, to the Pszczyna Castle, which is less than an hour away from my hometown. It is much smaller, it is perhaps less mysterious, but it just reminds me of those like British country houses in a way, especially with its beautiful English-style park. There is a bunch of beautiful ponds, there is bridges, there is wildlife, meadows, absolutely stunning. If you ever visit, go in spring, because I feel like the peak beauty is around like May, I'm thinking. At least that's when I always visit. So Daisy, who, as you probably have guessed, will be the subject of today's episode, lived in both of these places because she married Prince Hans Heinrich XV, who those castles belonged to. But she also lived in a lot of different places, to be honest, because the culture back then, that layer of society at least, was basically visiting people for weeks and months on end. And there is a lot of places that she lived in for just a little while or just visiting, but she moved around a lot. It was customary for a person of that range, and she definitely adjusted to that norm. So she would just like leave her children, go somewhere. She would miss them, of course, but then she was also like, yeah, I kind of need to go. She visited England a lot because that's where she comes from, and a lot of her friends and family lived there, and influential people that she wanted to meet, like the king and queen. So she was just like traveling all across Europe all the time, at least in her youth, in her like early marriage days. So the texts that we're reading today are her diaries, and it's not just her diaries, it's her diaries, and also there is a lot of like background talk by her, which is very nice. She is being really honest, I would say surprisingly honest sometimes, about what it was like to be a woman back then and basically going through an arranged marriage. What I also find really interesting is that this is an extremely wealthy woman, at least at the time, and it shows. She is trying to brush it off as, oh, I was actually really poor before we got married, or my husband used to do all these like outlandish things and I told him that we need to live more humbly. But at the end of the day, it is an incredible window into how absolutely vain and incredibly expensive lives of the very rich were back then. I think I used to look at it differently because when you're a young woman, any woman that was rich and beautiful inspires you, and especially historical women, you're just like, I want to be her. And it's just this fantasy of beautiful people living in beautiful places. But the older I get, the more I see how detached they were from reality. And you can tell she was trying to connect more with the working class, but not only was she the only one, so everyone else was like, what the hell are you doing? You don't need to be doing all that. But also it must have been extremely difficult to like break the local customs. Maybe the poor people were also like, we actually don't want you here. She probably just lacked the motivation, and she probably was just focused on being a mother. I'm just saying that I have a feeling she could have been a great philanthropist, and she was in a way, like she has done great things for people, as you will see. But knowing how wealthy and influential she was, I think she could have done much more. So we're going to jump right into her diary. To be fair, she did publish them herself, so I don't feel too bad. She published Daisy, Princess of Pless in 1928. And then she published From My Private Diary in 1931, which is pretty bold because it's pretty early on. Like, she wasn't that old yet. She just divorced her husband in 1922, spoilers. So it was a couple of years after. So this is still pretty fresh and raw. So the first memories that we will be reading are about her meeting and marrying her husband. And it is all a little bit sad, to be honest. Like, it just makes me anxious. I first met my future husband, Prince Henry of Pless, at a ball. Although in the German diplomatic corps and recently appointed a secretary of the German embassy in London, he did not, at that time, speak perfect English. I was shy and hardly understood a word he said. And a stupid little peer, who was there and who wanted to marry me, began to giggle. He is alive still, and I hope he reads this and will realize how cross he made me. Although only a girl, I felt he was being very rude to a foreigner, and I did not like it. Far from furthering his cause, it only made me sorry for Prince Henry, and inclined to be kinder to him than I might otherwise have been. So this was her first encounter with the prince. At the time, she was around 17, 18, he was around 29, 30. There was like a 12 years age gap. So that's pretty bad by modern standards. And then this is how she describes the proposal. Prince Henry proposed to me at a masked ball at Holland House. I did not know what on earth to say or do. I realized that my mother was ambitious and desired the match. In those absurd days, it was a big feather in a mother's cap if she could marry a daughter off during her first season. Marry her off, an odious phrase. I told Hans I did not love him. He said that did not matter. Love came after marriage. Perhaps it does sometimes, but I fear not often. This is such a read considering she's writing this after she divorced him. But it's interesting because in some of the entries, she actually does refer to him with a lot of like love and affection. But I'm assuming it was like circumstantial, like she had to love him in a way. So she talks a lot about the fact that when she got proposed to, she was just like a girl with a good name, with a good family, but they were not necessarily wealthy. They were impoverished. And she is really surprised that he doesn't mind. In Germany, every bride, whatever her rank, provides furniture, linen, trousseau, everything. Often she provides the house as well. In France, the custom is similar, although perhaps not quite so general. I could provide nothing, and my family could not even give me my trousseau on a fitting scale. Prince Henry, knowing all this, dazzled me with descriptions of life in Silesia. I was to have hunters, jewels, castles, two ladies in waiting, visit England every year, and goodness knows what. It all sounded splendid and romantic. To be fair, like, he did keep his promise of all the things that she mentioned. She got all that. She got to visit England a lot. She had two castles. She had jewels because upon her marriage, she was gifted the longest string of pearls in the world at the time, which was 7 yards or more. So he did keep his promise. But at the same time, what she notes next is a little heartbreaking because she says, I did not realize it clearly at the time, but I was just being bought, which is such a strong statement for someone who lived back then to say it like that, because that's practically what it was. All these things were transactional. So maybe she didn't have the money, but she was beautiful and young and of a good family, and she was what he needed at the time. He probably wasn't in love with her either. He was just like, yeah, she will do. So she was basically a product that they chose from. Yet after all these years, I must be perfectly fair to my husband. He did not, and never could, see it from my point of view. Instead of a wife who would add to the riches of his family, he was marrying someone without a penny. Braving the age-old customs of his own country, he was prepared to do it all himself, even to paying for the trousseau. Nothing could have exceeded the generosity with which he treated my family right up to the end of the war, and even after it. Again and again, he came to the help of one member or another. These things must not be forgotten. Even now, when his revenues are much diminished by the cruel post-war taxation in Germany and by the confiscatory policy of the Polish government, ooh, the shade, he lets me want for nothing in reason. But I am wondering and anticipating, as I fear a woman will. What she's referring to is the fact that he was so broke. He started off as one of the richest men in Europe, and he put a lot of money in like modernizing his castle and just spending it on stupid stuff. He was just bankrupt, and she could only rely to the rest of her life on the alimonies that he paid her. However, I do think it's interesting that she is writing all this at the time when he is still alive. Because, you know, it's more understandable to be nostalgic of someone when they've passed away. That's when you're like, oh yeah, they were a great person. They lit up the room every time they walked in. But when it's her ex-husband that's still alive, I think it shows great character to be like, yeah, he's done some good things. Like, we didn't get along, but it was basically a forced marriage for both of us. So he's not all bad. This is how she describes the day of her wedding. For breakfast on my wedding morning, I had sausages and bacon and wondered if they had anything so nice in Germany or only porridge. Germans are good with their sausages, I don't know what you're on about. The house was of course upside down, so I went out early and walked in the garden in the center of the square. I put on my oldest shoes, a funny little old turban hat, and soiled gloves. I had only an allowance of £12 a year for shoes and gloves and had learned to be careful. I remember rather wishing that Hans could see me looking such a fright, not want to marry me and go back to Germany without me. This is kind of sad because I remember thinking that way when I was like 17, 18. I was like, God, I kind of hope that, I don't know, my uni rejects me so I don't have to go. It's like doing things that you kind of wanted to do and you're supposed to do. But at the day of it, your anxiety is through the roof. You're like, I kind of hope I break my leg and just don't have to go. The marriage took place at St. Margaret's, Westminster. But I was far too excited to remember much about the ceremony, except that I had to wear a diamond coronet, which my father-in-law had given me as a wedding present. This is an interesting sort of motive that appears a lot in her diaries and writings. She was a sucker for good jewelry, and like, I can't blame her. If I was wearing a diamond coronet at my wedding, probably the only thing I would remember, but she does mention jewelry a lot. She does describe jewelry a lot, and it does sound to me like she actually enjoyed it, which is like one of those things that I mentioned that to me are a marker of her class and show us that she was maybe not too connected with what a regular person was thinking and feeling. Amongst my new titles, I was a Countess of the Holy Roman Empire, and the crown was a copy of the one worn in the old days by ladies of that rank. I have it still. So, as I said, really important to her. She also does mention a lot of famous names, and she is clearly very excited to know all these people, and it's important to her that those people respect and know her. So again, it's kind of like if I was reading a diary of a celebrity and they would be like, oh my God, I met John Lennon yesterday. He was so nice. So it's kind of this equivalent of this. Of course, the Prince and Princess of Wales were there and signed the register. My father, who looked so proud and handsome, gave me away. I remember wondering how little Sheila, that's her younger sister, was getting on in her first half-long frock, and they were really long in those days, because after all, she was only a child. I do not remember much else about the service, except that as I left the church, the dear English crowd, with its unique mixture of Cockney wit and sentiment, bless it, called out, God bless you. At the reception, I was rather pleased when the servants addressed me as Your Highness. I am not sure if she's describing her youthful sentiments of becoming someone so important and influential and rich, or if she still felt like that years after, if it was actually exciting for her. Because judging from the diaries, she did not feel too bad about being that person, about being worshipped almost, about being served, about being just so important. I began my married life totally unprepared for any of its experiences, duties, or responsibilities. Literally, I knew nothing. A short time before, I had overheard my mother telling a woman friend that so-and-so was in love with Daisy. I kept pondering what being in love meant. My experience was by no means an unusual one. Many girls of my period went through as bad or worse, but the convention ordaining such things was horrible and cruel. My parents, with hearts full of tender love, did nothing whatever to prepare me for life and its ordeals. I suppose I knew something, but only in a vague, furtive way. I had no fixed principle, no clear guiding thought. Without a rudder or chart, I was at the mercy of any wind that blew close enough to reach me. Either of my parents would have done anything in the world for me except tell me the truth. This is kind of deep, if you ask me. Like, first of all, she does acknowledge that as she's writing this in 1920s, the idea of selling off your daughter to a stranger is a little passé. It still happened, but it was not as custom, as common. And she says that it wasn't even that bad. Like, many girls had much worse experiences. But she also acknowledges how little help or preparation she received from her parents, that she was completely unprepared. I mean, of course, I get it. She was 18 and she was just like snatched away abroad to a foreign country to live in castles, a completely different environment. I ascribe many of the errors and misfortunes of my life to the fact that I not only married a man who was a stranger to me, but that I had no idea of how even to begin to get to know, much less to guide and influence him. Women at any rate will understand how utterly without knowledge of any kind I was, how scamped and short had been my social training, when I say that I did not even know how my smart French going away frock should be worn. So a going away dress was what you were wearing when you were leaving to go on your honeymoon. And she says, I put it on back to front. My husband, who has the keenest eye for women's clothes, was half amused and half cross when he saw it. He scolded me. It had to be hurriedly changed, and I drove away for my honeymoon, consumed with grief, humiliation, and dread of the unknown. This is such a symbolic story of a girl being so unprepared for what the life has in store for her, or for what her current or future lifestyle is going to be like, that she wore a dress back to front because she's never even seen a dress like this. I think she must be exaggerating a little bit because she was, after all, of a renowned family. And if she, as they say, was already a debutante, she was already like out in society, there is no way she wouldn't know how clothing works. But it's absolutely possible that these were the clothes that she's never seen before because they were too expensive. So now she describes Pless, the smaller castle, which I think was where they first stayed. When I arrived in Pless, I found a great white palace built on the site of an older one by my father-in-law about 1870. It is very French, as are most large German houses of that period, and was full of rather bad, heavy, over-gilded furniture, which was also supposed to be French, and which was nothing but ugly German. There were acres of terraces and gardens, and much indifferent statuary. A great deal of state and heavy luxury, no comfort or convenience, and not a single bathroom. My husband had made for me an ornate one of gold mosaic, now in Fürstenstein. Rather horrid, but much better than none. That's interesting that they didn't have a bathroom. It was 1891, so pretty late for it not to be there in a house that grand. But I guess it differed from country to country. I guess some countries were just a little behind. For my reception, all the retainers and servants were assembled in their best uniforms and liveries. Both at Pless and Fürstenstein, the organization of the household was on strictly military lines, and every servant had to do a daily drill. I soon found that the etiquette was unbelievably boring. I knew no German and could not make my wishes known. When I wanted to leave one room for another, a bell was rung, a servant opened the door, and a footman walked in front of me to wherever I wished to go. And all I wanted to do was to steal quietly away with a tight throat, or perhaps wait for the English post. One of the first things I did was to learn enough German to tell them that this ceremony was no longer necessary, and that I could open doors and liked to go to bed by myself. This my husband disapproved of, and all our lives together we had constant corroding bickerings about what he called interfering with the servants. What I find interesting about this is that I tend to think about England and the UK at the time as being very stiff when it comes to societal norms and customs like this, but it seems like in comparison to the continental Europe, and the other old countries, it was actually kind of relaxed, which is weird because I've been reading a lot of Edith Wharton's novels, and she always brings up the comparison of like the Americans versus the English, and the English being like really stiff, really old-fashioned, really old-timey in a way. And it turns out that compared to the rest of Europe, some of the customs were actually pretty relaxed, like what you could and couldn't do with staff. But I'm also thinking it might have been due to her kind of like jumping up the societal ladder and becoming a princess and not just like a regular aristocrat, because probably in her house, in her home, the customs would be completely different because they were just poorer. I said poorer, not poor, by the way. I never cared for Pless. I cackled when I read it the first time because one thing about Pszczyna, which is Pless that she's describing, is they absolutely love Daisy. They probably love Daisy more than the other castle. The whole town is like, Daisy this, Daisy that. There is a statue of Daisy. There is Daisy's favorite place. There is like a Daisy parade. They are obsessed with Daisy. And the fact that the first thing that she writes about Pszczyna is like, I never cared for it really, is kind of ironic. I never cared for Pless, but my father-in-law, whom we all called Vater, loved it. In his eyes, one of its most interesting features was his famous stud of magnificently bred horses. A roan chestnut was his favorite color, and I can see now in my mind's eye a perfect stallion called Rapid Roan. Isn't that like a pop singer? We had nearly always to be at Pless for Christmas, which was not a bit like Christmas at home. We had pretty German Christmas songs, but no crackers, mince pies, or plum puddings. Thank God, mince pies suck. Later on, I used to procure these from England and have a private little celebration in my own room, in which my English maid and my husband's English valet joined. Had I done this in public, everyone would have thought that I was seriously trying to undermine the constitution of the Kingdom of Prussia. This is kind of cute. Like, this is one of the aspects of her that make me think that she would actually be a good philanthropist. She would just invite her English maid and English valet to have a Christmas dinner. Just like eat mince pies and plum puddings. This is kind of cute. I much preferred our occasional Christmases at Fürstenstein, so the other castle. They were very happy, almost sacred, because all our guards, servants, and dependents and their families came and celebrated Christmas with us. There were presents for everyone, and it was great fun choosing suitable ones. Some of my English friends used to come over to stay and help us, and for the first time, everyone was free and happy. This is one of the very nicest sides of German life, that on such occasions, perfect equality obtains between prince and peasant. Yeah, so you allow them in like once a year, then you're like, okay, get back to work now. The castle of Fürstenstein occupies a magnificent position. It crowns a great pointed pine-clad rock over 200 feet high on the southwest and north, and dominates an enormous stretch of country filled with forests, lakes, and wide stretches of open plain, which fade away to the distant Silesian mountains. Many of the old rooms in one part of the house are actually in the rock, and to reach the castle, one must approach it from the east and cross the great stone bridge, which spans a river flowing far down below at the bottom of a deep ravine. The roads to the castle all gradually ascend, and the approach from any direction is an ever-changing vista of enchanting loveliness. This I will agree with. The castle and the location absolutely slap. And it still looks like that. There is still a bridge that you need to cross. It's still beautiful. It is situated close to the western border of Silesia, where it touches what was the old Bohemian frontier in the picturesque mountain country known in Germany as Sudetengebirge, which in Polish is probably Sudete. But she says that Fürstenstein was not actually more chill in terms of all of the ceremonies. So she said that it was the same. The state, too, as at Pless, irked me. For years I was not allowed to use a motor. I'm assuming she's referring to a car, but was always met at the station by a semi-state carriage with postilions. At Pless and Furstenstein, a gorgeously dressed man with a cocked hat and a tall silver staff was always on duty outside the front door. He signaled one's approach to the servants, flourished his great stick, and saluted like a regimental drum major of the English guards. Privately, I christened him Guy Fawkes. Then she says something which I think shows the detachment that I was talking about. So what she says is, I have always been, in a way, a socialist, and hated our liveries all smothered in silver lace, and the unnecessary servants for nothing but show. On gala occasions, at least 30 men waited at dinner. I am quite sure it is wrong to flaunt one's riches and power. To do things well in a quiet and dignified way is quite another matter. One expects to see a lady well-dressed and with good shoes and lingerie, but she need not lift up her skirts as if to say, look at my Valenciennes. All the display made me feel like a nouveau riche, and eventually I persuaded my husband to reduce some of it. I think it shows that her heart was like in the right place, but being in an environment like this, she thought it's radical to get rid of some servants, or like, we don't need silver lace. But she would probably still not be happy to give up all her riches, to give up all her privilege. And she did end up dying quite impoverished and alone. It's funny to me how people are like, yeah, when she was dying, she only had like one servant. In 1943, when she passed away, that is still incredibly rich. She died in a villa. Everyone's like, yeah, she was so poor. Yeah, people were literally eating corpses at the time. Not to be too graphic, but that's literally what happened around her. And I think she went through life just not realizing how privileged she is, which is completely understandable. She was not even in touch with reality. She was shielded from it and probably against her will too. But things that she writes that sound like this, like, I have always been in a way a socialist because I think 30 men that are waiting on you at dinner are just too much. But she would still eat dinner that someone else prepared for her. She would still eat dinner in a massive dining room. I don't think she ever understood how big of a deal it is that she is able to do that at that time. When I first married, I was told that it was not considered fürstlich, that is princely, for me to go about among our people at Furstenstein and Pless. But after a few years, I took the law into my own hands, ordered my carriage, and went where I chose. I remember in those early days going to see a new hospital in Schweidnitz, so Świdnica in Poland nowadays, but this is one of the things I'm talking about. She was in her philanthropist era. She was like, I actually need to do something. I have all this money. Let me go to a hospital and see what can be done. I thought the doctor who conducted me round was most brutal. I did not want to see all the horrors he showed me or to disturb the poor sick people. Some of the sights almost made me ill. Afterwards, my husband told me that most probably the doctor did it on purpose to disgust me so that I should never wish to go there again. Those middle-class men in authority preferred to rule their own roosts and have no critical eye from outside to mark their shortcomings. This man was one of those who, later on, most bitterly opposed our efforts to cleanse the filthy river into which many towns drained. At one time, the death rate of those towns was enormous. My English ideas of sanitation were outraged, and for many years, I fought to have this disgraceful state of affairs put right. She did fight for some sanitary changes, and this is one of the reasons why I say that she was a bit of a philanthropist, because she did influence people locally to change the sewage system into more sanitary. This is a fragment that I thought was interesting because this was written in 1920s, and it always shocks me. I mean, it's obvious, but it always shocks me that people are like, yeah, the war was really bad. Thank God we're not going to go through this again because this one was so traumatic. And it's just always such a heavy thing to read. So here is what she says. If I cannot claim to have lived in the midst of great events, I have at any rate hovered on their outside edge. Perhaps therefore, what I have thought and said may have something more than a merely personal interest. We all cherish the wistful hope or delusion that what we were and what we did are somehow significant, and we long to leave behind us some memorial, however humble, that will outlast the years and still keep our memory green, perhaps even fragrant, when all who knew and loved us are no more. The period in which I live, and some of the people in the circles in which I moved, have already become historic. My life before the First World War seems to me so far away that I can read and write about it as if it concerned another being and events in another world. And then she goes on to quote her actual diaries. So all of these things so far, it was a memoir, I would say. So she was writing it retrospectively. Now, these are actual diary entries that she wrote. October 15th, 1902. The Castle Pless. Again, I begin a diary. A waste of time, perhaps. Yet in years to come, it may interest me to remember all that I did and thought, or perhaps not at all, at the age of 29. I am in the middle of the second phase of my life, and alas, I begin to write in a spirit of sadness. With many illusions gone, most of my ideals broken, for I have come to believe that nothing really exists except in one's imagination, and most of the gold has rubbed off the dazzling frames that held but phantom pictures. She sounds pretty dramatic, but I'm assuming she must have had some sort of a crisis. Don't we all at the age of 29? Let's be real. Then she gives a description of her, which I think also tells us about how self-confident she was. She's not really ever describing her looks or her character in derogatory terms. She's usually pretty positive. I am fair and tall. I look well when I have spent some time in front of my glass, with my head maid Marie near to cheer me with compliments. Some think me lovely, but there is no accounting for tastes. My husband, who is playing the piano as I write, says that I am all that he wants. Such a declaration should be sufficient to satisfy the desire of any good and modest woman. But possibly, I am neither good nor modest. I am perhaps not quite an ordinary woman because I still see the need of fighting and do fight. Whereas so many seem to give up the battle and are satisfied to float along upon the tide of existence. I have a great longing to make people happy. I try to do what is right, and yet it is not with any religious motives that I dream of living with heart and hand full for the poor, the miners, and the needy socialists about here. Indeed, I sometimes fear that my God is one whom no man or woman shall ever see. So she suggests that her main sort of goal in life is to help the poor, and then she goes on to describe the work that she has been doing. It is now 2 years since I started to go about among the working people. Before that, I was always being told it was not princely to do so, and that if I went, it would only mean giving money and help of that sort. True, Vater, that's her father-in-law, has his own infant school, a school of cookery for girls, school of handicraft for boys, gives Christmas trees and arranges similar entertainments. But I want to get to the heart of people and understand them, and now in sheer desperation I have broken bounds. I order my carriage and go where I choose. Almshouses, hospitals, homes for old people, everywhere. In time, my personal interest in my poorer neighbors will be acceptable and I hope helpful. So she was on a mission. I'm assuming it was customary for women after being married for quite a long time and being disillusioned with their lifestyles to find like a mission for themselves. There is a lot of rich women that after a certain age, they were just like, I actually need to do something or I'm gonna go insane. And this looks like it was the mission for her. I am reading this entry because it's about Chatsworth, which I find to be one of the finest houses in the UK, like historic houses, and it's still beautiful. And it's just interesting to me that she was there so often. So we're gonna read about what they did there. And this is, to me, a good description of how idle their lives were at the time, because they're not doing anything substantial. January the 6th, 1903. Chatsworth, Derbyshire. Arrived here late last night, dressed in a great hurry, but got downstairs in good time. The Duchess of Devonshire is marvelous and looks marvelous for her 74 years. Always very décolleté in the evening, with dresses that only a woman of 30 should wear, and yet she does not really seem dressed too young. She generally has a wreath of green leaves in her hair, or rather wig. What a read! This evening, being Twelfth Night, we all danced around the Christmas tree. Soveral is a Portuguese minister that was also visiting. Soveral leading the Duchess. Then the girls and I ducked for an apple. I could not get it. And we cut a cake containing charms. Little Princess Beatrice of Coburg cut the ring, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Balfour, got a little gold heart, perhaps to make up for the real one that he missed years ago. I'm not sure what she's referring to here, but it sounds like she's sassy. After that, we danced in the long passage, which, however, is really much too narrow for the purpose. I cannot think why they do not use the rooms upstairs, or take the table away from the billiard room, which is never used as everyone plays bridge. And there are always a lot of girls here who want to dance. Now I'm trying to remember what narrow passage could she refer to in terms of where they could dance, because there is a lot of space in Chatsworth, so I'm not sure why there was not enough space for dances. But descriptions like this make me also nostalgic for traditions that were not necessarily religious, but they were just reasons for a celebration. I feel like together with dropping religious holidays, like we just stopped celebrating a lot of them, we also kind of dropped a lot of fun. Like ducking for an apple, cutting a cake containing charms, all of these traditions that were just something to look forward to, you know, in a winter season when literally nothing's going on. It was actually not stupid to have dates on which something fun would be happening. And this is something I think we should definitely bring back. Let's bring back random celebrations on particular days. And then she says, tomorrow we rehearse before luncheon. So in the afternoon, I shall go out and join the guns. They kept putting up those plays. So they would like rehearse and then act out theatrical pieces on stage, which I'm assuming was like makeshift, because I don't remember there being an actual stage in Chatsworth. So this is how she describes it. We acted last night after only 3 days rehearsing, while we ought to have had a week. It all went well, except in my monologue when I was alone on the stage for 20 minutes. I suddenly forgot my cue, and the ass of a prompter, who was not following, lost the page and did not know where to find it. So I had to say, please give me the words. Some of them say that I stamped my foot and said, damn the man, but I am sure I didn't. The last play, Shades of Night, went very well, and I enjoyed playing the ghost, which is really the best part. We act again on Monday the 12th. So she says the last play, so it probably was a couple of different short plays that they acted out, which I think is interesting, because if you only rehearse for 3 days, no wonder you don't remember a 20-minute monologue. Like, they had high expectations, but on the other hand, they had literally nothing else to do. But it was a popular pastime, and clearly they all enjoy it, and they're all really into it. Then she describes Soveral, so the Portuguese minister that I mentioned earlier. Soveral, the Portuguese minister, is the oddest character at present in English society. He imagines himself to be a great intellectual and a political force, and the wise advisor of all the heads of the government, and of course, the greatest danger to women. I amuse myself with him, as it makes the other women furious, and he is sometimes very useful. He is so swarthy that he is nicknamed the Blue Monkey, and I imagine that even those stupid people who believe that every man who talks to a woman must be her lover could not take his Don Juan-esque pretensions seriously. Yet I am told that all women do not judge him so severely, and some even find him très séduisant. How disgusting. Anyway, from now on, I will not go alone with him to the theater or to lunch at a restaurant. He hates the German emperor and I am sure has a very bad influence on King Edward in this direction. I find it funny how she just flirts with him for fun because she's bored, her husband's not there, and it's a recurring theme where she's just like, yeah, I'm gonna play with this a little, but it was never actually serious. I'm assuming it must have been socially accepted because no one ever gives her any shit for doing it. If anything, they are actually more upset with the men who are trying to seduce a married woman. It also kind of shows that at a certain level of society, no one could tell you anything. Like, yes, if she was involved in some actual scandal, her reputation would probably get ruined. But innocent flirtations like that were completely normal. January 19th, 1903, Newlands, Hampshire. I was, on the whole, pleased to leave Chatsworth. Girl, it's the most beautiful place on earth and you were bored? The time seemed to drag there. The last day's acting went off very well, except that in Shades of Night, Mr. Leo Trevor forgot his lines and the prompter, an idiot as they all seem to be, never gave them to him. And this time he also had to say, give me a word. This consoled me when I remembered what happened two nights before in my monologue. So I'm just wondering if they actually hired a prompter or if it was a servant that was just doing that, because she says that they all seem to be. So like all prompters in general. And I'm thinking it would be very extravagant to hire a prompter for an amateur play that you're staging up in your own house. But I wouldn't put it past them though. On the Saturday, nearly everyone left. I walked with the Duchess in the afternoon and told her all about Germany and her old friends. She was quite amused and interested, although generally she is not easy to talk to. On Tuesday night, I dined in London with Consuelo Manchester to meet the King. He told me I was très en beauté, so very beautiful. I always feel rather shy when he talks like that. During dinner, he spoke very freely, too freely, about Germany, America, Venezuela, and so on. The Duchess and her sister, Lady Lister Kay, are Americans, and so is Adele Essex, who was also there, being the only ladies, apart from Mrs. George Capel. That's actually one of his lovers. On several occasions, they turned apologetically to me, but the King said, oh, Daisy doesn't mind. Being married to a German does not make her change her national feelings. I thought neither does it make one insensible, so I let them go on arguing and talking about everything. And when they had finished, I had my say at them and then dropped my fan, and someone coming to pick it up caused a change in a conversation. It's interesting how at that point the King was not just someone that you had to like worship and be wary of, but also you could tell him shit. His lovers and some other women that were at the table would just like argue with the King and be like, no, that's too harsh. Like, you can't say that in front of her. And he's like, no, she doesn't mind. So all these conversations must have been pretty relaxed considering he was the head of country. Then in her diaries mentions that she is getting very homesick, and this is also a common theme, just this nostalgia for England. Like, even in the Christmas story, when she's like, oh, you know, Christmas used to be so nice in England. We used to get minced pies and puddings, and now we don't. Even the food she worships as if it was something incredible. And let's face it, minced pies? Come on. There is so many good British foods, but this is not one of them. Okay, this is a controversial take. Cancel me if you want, but minced pies are not it. And I'm just saying that she felt nostalgic for anything. She would be like, yeah, English weather is so nice. And you're reading this like, girl, what are you even on about? I'm not saying German weather is much better, but this is not the thing to be nostalgic for. And this is what she wrote about being homesick. Oh well, I must try to be less spoiled and not wail for all that I cannot have. But alas, with the years that pass by, I sometimes feel more homesick than ever, and wish once more, with all my soul, that this beautiful place, she's referring to the First Sunshine Castle, that this beautiful place were in England. this is sort of hypocritical of her because she's like, we need to help the poor. I'm talking to the servants. Everyone hates me because I'm not like other girls and I'm using my carriage to actually interact with people. But then she writes things like this. July 20th, 1903, Sunday, Fürstenstein. We all went to service in the private chapel in the morning. Because I felt sad, I longed for a nice service in an English church with a beautiful organ and hymns and freedom to kneel down to my God and feel alone. Instead of that, we all sat perched side by side on high state chairs, and it made me want to laugh. The service lasted only 1 hour. The smell was horrid. All the poor people in their best stuffy Sunday clothes having walked here in the heat. It's July, so I mean fair, people will be sweaty, but girl, so are you. And then the kitchen is underneath the chapel, and I kept on smelling the menu I had just looked over with the cook. I felt inclined to laugh too, in the course of one psalm where it is written, Macht deiner Lichter hell. I can't spell it alright, but it means make thy lights bright. For at that moment, one of the attendants, in a long blue cloak with a long stick and a snuffer at the end, went to the altar and extinguished the 2 candles. Dear Vater, trying to sing is enough to upset anyone. It is like a nest of bumblebees very close, or far distant thunder. So while at Fürstenstein, she describes a guy that was trying to like flirt with her in a really indiscreet way, and everyone around her was just like laughing it off, but she was like, this is not right, my husband's not here, this kind of sucks. And this also to me shows how it was just like the norm, like there would be single influential guys trying to get other people's wives and everyone was okay with it. I mean, not okay with them getting the wives, but everyone's like, yeah, yeah, of course he's in love with you. I mean, that makes sense. So this is how she describes it. Prince Joachim Albrecht went away and returns tomorrow. He went off again with my handkerchief. It is quite strange that Vater and Mathilde really do not seem to mind, a bit, his boyish open flirtation. Vater kissed me last night and seemed quite pleased, and before the prince left this morning, Mathilde went to him and said, I think my daughter-in-law really wants her handkerchief. Afterwards, she said to me, he gave it to me without a word, making me feel quite sorry. Sorry for a guy that's trying to get with your daughter-in-law? That's kind of weird. Later, Vilush got it somehow and gave it back to the prince. So they keep stealing her handkerchiefs for like absolutely no reason. July 25th, 1903, Fürstenstein. This evening, as usual, I sang and the prince, so the guy that she just described, played his cello. How childish most royalties are as a rule. He now has 3 of my pocket handkerchiefs. He got so close to me on the sofa that Mathilde says Vater made a face at him and he moved away. I did not notice all this. I noticed so little, really. Okay, so her father-in-law had to scare away a guy that is trying to like get in her pants. This is so, so weird. The next entry that I want to read is really interesting because she describes being at a fortune teller, and she went with her mother too. When in London, Patsy and I went to a fortune teller in Bond Street. She was extraordinary, told me the past absolutely, and described Hans and the baby. She also said I shall have another baby before I am 31, and that dear Vater will not live 3 years more. This is kind of intense for a fortune teller. I mean, today it's more like, yeah, you have to focus on yourself. There will be a new person in your life. And she's straight up like, so your father-in-law is not gonna live more than 3 years from now on. She also said that I have a great power and magnetism over people, which will increase so much that I shall have to take care. Some of my friends will remain true to me forever. They will stand by me always, no matter what happens. I think this one is pretty sad because she actually did die completely alone. I must avoid making people unhappy. At the age of 34, I shall be lifted off my feet by some extraordinary power. I suppose in some person. Then she astonished me more than ever by saying, you have a sister who will come more into your life than she has ever before. I cannot see how this can ever be. We live so far apart. And I see a gloom around her. She will not be a happy woman. I cannot bear to dwell on this last prophecy, and I will not believe it and pray to God it may be otherwise. This entry, to me, it was eye-opening because I did realize that people practiced recreational hunting back then. Obviously, it was a popular pastime, especially in this social sphere. However, I did not realize the extent of the killing that took place. I thought you were just like, yeah, we shot like 12 birds. She says, today we shot about 800 head. And she personally shot about 30 pheasants and some hare. That's in one day. That's an incredible amount of animals. Nobody needs 30 pheasants. What did they even do with the 800 animals that they've killed? It's so weird. It snowed hard in the morning, but was fine and nice in the afternoon. Having got very wet, I sent for another pair of boots and stockings and changed in the tent when the men had left. I had to lower my panties to get at my suspenders, and Mathilde and Ma Asberg helped me. To think of my doing this with them about 10 years ago. Mais nous avons changé tout cela, which is... How has everything changed? Something like that. I don't know French, actually. This evening, Ma and I dressed up in my dancing dresses and danced skirt dances before them all. Cakewalks and Spanish dances. This is, by the way, the same day of the hunting. So it could not have lasted long because by the evening time, they were already back home dancing. Prince Salm played tunes on the pianola, which is most useful and delightful to have. 8 years ago, my dear old father-in-law did not like to walk with me in Berlin unless I wore a little black gown. Now, after I had danced and delighted him, Hans said, Vater was off his head and said you were so graceful. All that Mathilde said when I took her to her room was, try and remember when you hold your skirt to catch only the top skirt of the crepe de chine, for once or twice you caught the underskirt too, and one could see up to your knee. But she did not really seem the least shocked. I can scarcely believe they are the same people. My brother-in-law Connie, who used to always say to me, Daisy spricht doch Deutsch. Daisy speaks German, basically. Now writes to me in English to thank me for his charming visit to Furstenstein. Well, if no one belonging to the outside world about here liked me and everything felt wrong, I should still have the comfort and satisfaction of feeling that Hans' relations like me. Bless them. Hansel, thank God, is very well. Hansel is her son. And how he loves me. And Mathilde is too dear and nice with him. Mathilde is her mother-in-law. I am sure I don't know whether it is shocking or not, but I have my bath with him every evening. He is not 4 years old yet, so I do not think it can matter. It does sound pretty, pretty modern to be taking a bath with your child in an era where barely anyone took baths at all because water had to be heated up. She also complains a lot about the press. So obviously being at the very top of the society and also being British, she was subject to a lot of press coverage at the time and she hated it. And it's really interesting to me to read this because it does sound like modern celebrities saying like, we actually have no privacy and everything is so invasive. And it's been going on for so long. So she's writing this in like 1903 and she says, that autumn, while we were at Gopsel with the house, we had some quite harmless charades. A stupid American newspaper correspondent got hold of a garbled account of these from one supposes a drunken servant or some such source. No sober person could have supplied material for the vulgar headlines and extracts which appeared in a New York newspaper. Princess Henry of Pless a Romeo, Lady Sarah Wilson in kilts, Marlborough aunts in armor and kilts. As an example of American journalism of that time, part of the account itself is perhaps worth reprinting. Lady Howe was dressed as a Knight Templar with a long black cloak with a white cross, a two-handed sword, bright steel armor and helmet. Her sister, Lady Sarah Wilson, more daring, appeared as Prince Charlie in kilts and made a very attractive, well-shaped young man. Princess Henry of Pless made an extremely graceful, though over-tall, Romeo. It was generally voted that she would make the fame of any chorus. Her nether extremities are so divinely shaped. But historically, the success of the evening was Mrs. George Cornwallis West, formerly Lady Randolph Churchill, who came as a roistering Spanish cavalier. She wore a black silk tights, doublet and hose, a dark crimson velvet cloak trimmed with gold, had a sword, a great diamond blazing in her black sombrero with its drooping feathers, diamond buckles on her pretty shoe, and a black mustache waxed and ferociously curled like the Kaiser's. The ladies were at first rather shy about entering the room in their unaccustomed but most becoming costumes, and shrinkingly tried to hide their legs behind the skirts of their lady companions. But this feeling soon wore off, and everything went as gaily as possible. It was odd to see what appeared to be men dancing with men partners. The affair was not to be talked about, it was understood, but it has come out nevertheless and excites the greatest interest. So this is what they wrote in the newspaper. So basically, they were describing pretty normal outfits at the time. Costume parties were nothing new, and women were wearing male-inspired costumes at least since 1890s, and this was 1903, if I'm correct. So this is definitely like sensationalist to be like, yeah, they were so naked. Actually, you could see their legs, and they were actually ashamed to even walk into the room. This and much else far more lurid was cabled to New York and, if you please, copyrighted throughout the world. The only amusing notion in the whole effusion was the idea of Sarah Wilson in kilts. Why anyone should be supposed to wear several at a time, only writers and newspapers know. Other American papers devoted front pages to even more ridiculous accounts of an affair that never happened, illustrating their nonsense with portraits of Sarah Wilson, Jenny, and myself. A true and more amusing incident had, however, happened at Aloha House in October, while we were staying with Violet Marr and Kelly and her husband. We produced a pantomime rehearsal. We had great fun and none of us quarreled. But something too funny happened to me. Just as I was going onto the stage, I had tripped over what I thought was some sort of the cord of electric lights. I did not take any notice, but when I came off again, Muriel Wilson, who had been just behind me, said with a sympathetic face, "My dear, how awful for you," and gave me a little bundle of silk and lace. It was not my petticoat. She had seen something hanging down, and as it was too late to stop me from going on the stage, she gave it a little tug, and down they came. She is, of course, talking about her pantaloons, so basically panties, that just came off as she was going on stage, and her lovely friend, to spare her embarrassment, just like basically took them off, like pulled on them, so they just came off. How on earth I could have stepped out of them without knowing is not really a puzzle, because when acting, I always forget all about myself. So most of her entries are, as you can tell, quite humorous or light, or it's just like daily life. However, there are some diary entries that you can clearly tell she's been going through it. She was not well. She was having doubts regarding her lifestyle. She was just unhappy. And one of those entries is this one. And I think it tells you a lot about how she felt about her life at the time. Deep in my heart, I keep hearing, is it an echo of genuine life somewhere in this world, or intimations of some past or future existence that was or shall be mine in close communion with some ideal love? My true beloved, whose hands will hold up my face, whose voice will sound ever caressingly in my ear, come, little one, away from it all, to a home in the woods near the sea, in some far, fair country, where you will. A spot where you can be up to greet God's sun in the fresh awakening of each morning and go to bed by the light of his moon. No electric lights from glittering candelabra. The scent of the flowers at evening floating in through open windows. The thrill of crisp air over white snow. No artificial perfumes in gilded salons. Home and peace, I game to shoot, horses to ride, bodily work to do, not the perpetual harassing of the brain to answer notes, send telegrams, chatter through telephones, live only for and in the worship of God, tending the new lives that spring from us. But I must drop this nonsense. This is probably the first time in these diary entries, because of course we do not have access to all of them. She might have skipped some of them, but this is the first time where she fully describes her fantasy, which is so incredibly telling that she is literally living in castles. She has all the riches in the world. She travels extensively. She knows people that everyone wanted to know. And all she longs for is a simple life. It's like not even having electricity, is bodily work to do, not having to answer any letters, not having to interact with anyone, just like living somewhere with her children and perhaps a lover or a love that she longs for, but is not an actual person. She's not actually referring to anyone in particular. She just longs to be loved by someone. And this is not something that she was getting from her husband. The hotel band downstairs is still playing. May it make them happy. And tomorrow I shall again wear diamonds and dance. Yet my soul lives in my distant dream house, a little house, but big as the kingdom over which love reigns. For now I am alone, alone in an alien country, trying my best to do my share fairly, to do my best. And no one knows but God and myself what is in my heart. I drove Hans to the station. I must try and keep him. I cried myself to sleep last night, or rather at 6 this morning. I felt so sad and miserable that I nearly went to fetch Hansel to come into my bed. God, diary, don't you understand what it all means to a woman like me, feted and admired by everyone else, and who has a determination to fight the evil in life, a terror of being disappointed, a longing for what is good and noble. The clock ticks as I write. There is wind and snow outside. My soul is lonely and my mind afraid, and I dread the night, for I sleep so badly, always worse here than anywhere. This is maybe a little pessimistic note to end with, but this is a reality. She was not satisfied with the life that she was living. She was thriving in it in a way, because you can tell that all of this flatters her. But at the end of the day, she is just like, my life is so empty. I'm not actually doing anything substantial. And this is something that is echoed by many women of that era, by many women that were rich and married off to someone. They do not have a purpose. They just do not have anything to do with their lives. And this must have been like a mental torture to know that you're not actually needed. You've already like birthed your children. Yes, you are a mother, but you don't even spend time with them. You're away all the time anyway. They have nannies and nurses bringing them up. You've done your part and you're basically useless. Like, you're just a product that was bought and it's now not needed anymore. And this is why I feel bad for her, even though we have to acknowledge that she was incredibly privileged from beginning to the end. And she probably didn't even realize, which is, again, a product of her times, was believing that some people are just destined to live like this. But yeah, I just think it's pretty sad. And she did go through life like being admired, but never really like truly loved, which is pretty tragic in a way. So yeah, this is why I kind of think she's like a Polish Lady Diana or a Polish Marilyn Monroe, whereas like an iconic character, not Polish, because she wasn't Polish, but for Polish people, because it's this iconic character that everyone reminisces and remembers, but they were also incredibly unhappy. And while also being beautiful and influential women. But this is far-fetched. This is a hot take that Daisy von Pless was a Polish Diana. This is a hot take, but they do share some similarities, and they're probably also related, as all British royals are. So anyway, this is all for this episode. And also, important thing, I am actually going on a break. Textory is going on a break. So I will whip up some new episodes for you, and I will be back after a Christmas break. Enjoy your Christmas, enjoy the New Year's, and I'll see you again in the next episode. Bye.
Click
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.